to Upzoned, your weekly look into the conversations we're having behind the scenes at Strong Towns about policy, infrastructure, building, economics, literally anything that touches our conversation that we think deserves to go into a little bit more depth. Each week, we select one big story from the news and we upzone it. Today, I am here, I'm Kia, by the way, with my colleague Daniel Harrigus, and he is filling in for Chuck this week because A, I wanted to talk to him, and B, he actually sent me a really fascinating article that I wanted to talk to all of you about. It's from the New York Times, and the headline is a little provocative, and I think what's in it is a little bit even more thought-provoking. It's "The New American Dream Home is One You Never Have to Leave" by Candace Jackson. Daniel, I wanted to say first, how you doing? And second, could you tell me a little bit about this article and why we decided to upzone it this week?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. Fall has finally arrived here in Southwest Florida, which is what the rest of you in the rest of the country know as summer. It's like 80 degrees and there's a breeze and it's beautiful. So I'm really happy and have been biking everywhere, which kind of went on hold during the summer months. It feels really good to get back out there on my bike again.
I've never asked you what kind of bike you have. I'm a huge bike nerd. Would you reveal it to the audience?
I've got a giant commuter bike, giant to the brand, not giant to the size, as I am a diminutive individual. No, it's just one of those hybrid bikes, good for tooling around town. And I use it for transportation as much as I can, which is mostly in this part of the country limited by the summer weather.
Yeah, I had a giant commuter for a while and I had to scrap it because disc brakes are the bane of my life, but otherwise it was a pretty good bike. So let's get back on track here. All right. Tell me a little bit about this New York Times article and why you decided to bring it to my attention.
As you said, the article is called "The New American Dream Home is One You Never Have to Leave." And the subtitle that the author gave it is "Forget the game room and formal dining. You need space for aging parents and Airbnb guests." And it came to my attention because I am one of my little, you know, pet topics of particular interest is accessory dwelling units. I've lived in several. I love them. I've written about them for Strong Towns. They are such a versatile way to make a neighborhood more functional for people in all walks of life. And here comes this article about Lennar, which is one of the largest just sort of cookie cutter home builders nationwide, selling this new model home called Next Gen, which has an attached one-bedroom suite kind of built into it so that you can have guests and give them their own little kitchenette and bath and privacy, or you can have someone live with you. You know, it is functionally, it's an accessory dwelling unit. You could have an aging parent live with you. You could be the aging parent and have an adult child live there. And it really said to me something about where we're going, where the housing market is going, where people's lifestyles are going, that this is no longer kind of a niche thing. If a huge corporate home builder is now looking at this and saying, there's a huge market for this, people want this.
It blows my mind that this isn't more widespread. When I read this article, I actually, another reason I wanted to have you on, was struck by how they talked about this particular home style, particularly appealing to first-time home buyers, to millennials, to today's home buyers who want to, I think there's a great quote in the article about how the first-time home buyers want to not turn over their home in the next 5 years. The word starter home has sort of fallen out of the vocabulary, but they actually want to endure in place. I realized that I don't know this, Daniel. Are you a homeowner? And did you ask these sort of questions when you were choosing where you wanted to live?
I am a homeowner, and my wife and I have owned our home in Sarasota for a couple of years. The enduring in place thing was not necessarily the biggest factor in our conversation, though I know that it is for other people, and the article addresses that. But something else that's addressed by this article that was big for us was versatility in the event that our circumstances were to change. So we looked for a property that was close to my wife's job so that she could walk to work on nice days. I could drop her off easily. We can get by with one car. And that was important to us, to not have to be a two-car household. And it's also a place, it's in a neighborhood full of college students. It could easily become a rental property with that student market in the event that we don't want to live here anymore, but we also don't feel in a position to sell or simply don't want to sell. So we were looking at the uncertainty in our future, where we were going to be living, what our jobs were going to look like, what we were going to want, and making a purchase that was sort of risk averse in that respect, because it would work for us even if our circumstances changed dramatically. And that's something I see in a lot of my friends of my generation.
Same here. I mean, I've talked in the podcast and on the site many times about the fact that my partner and I own a duplex. And for me, that was because I graduated in 2009 from college. You might have heard of that year. It was the peak of the financial crisis. And one of the things the article by Candace Jackson talks about a lot is that we as a generation, I think, I hope I can speak for you when I say that I consider you a millennial, Daniel.
I consider myself one.
Okay, good. Never want to, if you wanted to adopt a Generation X, I would forgive you, but because millennial has so many pejorative conversations. But one
I will
thing
adopt
this,
millennial or Oregon Trail generation.
Yes.
I was born in 84.
Gosh. Always choose the banker in the first round. That's the key to success. In any case, one thing that I feel the article got really right is that our generation grew up amidst economic trauma. We don't expect our houses to be an enduring investment in and of themselves. So we look for houses that are going to meet our economic needs in other ways, whether that's enabling us to go down to just one car, whether that's providing rent for us, in the form of an accessory dwelling unit on the back of the house or a full-scale apartment on the front of the house like I have. And we bring a different set of concerns to the home buying process that I don't know if everyone's parents, but at least my parents barely ever thought about. They would buy the most house that they could get, and then they would, you know, flip it in a few years and they trusted that it would gain value. Tell me a little bit about do you agree? Is that what your parents did? And was that the same trajectory they took?
I don't know that I see myself in that lineage. You know, I think my parents really, I don't want to speak too much for their thought process, but I always perceived that they emphasized frugality and that they lived it. And we had a nice house, but it was a house that they were comfortably able to afford in the city. They never wanted to move out to the McMansion in the suburbs. But they did follow a very traditional trajectory. You know, you get married, you have a kid, you buy your house, then you buy a nicer house, and it very much that American dream, where single family home ownership was just part of the trajectory of what you're going to do in your life. I think non-traditional arrangements, even that involve home ownership, my sense is that they're more common now, and that statistics on the home ownership rate, like the New York Times article cites that rate has declined from something like 69% to 64% in recent years. And I think that actually downplays the significance of that transition. You know, I have a good friend who lives out in the San Francisco Bay Area and lucked into home ownership in Berkeley for a number of reasons. She saved money really diligently after college, but she had some help from family. She has a rental unit on the property. She has a number of ways of making it work. And she's a public school teacher in Oakland. And I had a conversation with her where she said, I make a point of telling people about all the nitty-gritty details of my situation, even if I don't know them that well, because I don't want people to think that you can own a home in this city on an Oakland teacher's salary. I want them to understand that everyone has some side hustle or unusual arrangement or help from family or something that they're doing in order to make it work. And that to me feels like a huge part of the story of our generation.
I'm wondering if our generation is sort of uniquely poised to become Strong Towns advocates for all these same reasons. I've been thinking a lot about why I'm attracted to Strong Towns, and a lot of it has to do with taking, I guess, the trajectory we're describing, realizing as I came into young adulthood that housing was not the bet. It was the safe bet that I was always told it would be, realizing that I needed to build resiliency into every aspect of my life, not just my home. I've always been someone who's held a second or a third job, even when I'm stably employed at a full-time job, because I like to have you know, escape hatches under escape hatches in case something goes wrong. And I know a whole lot of people who are like that in my generation. And eventually I started extrapolating that line of thinking out to the city that I live in, which I see is so fragile, which doesn't operate its household income the way that I operate mine. Do you think that being a millennial poised you uniquely to become a Strong Towns fan?
I'm not sure. I'd like to think so, because that would give me hope for what happens to the world as our generation assumes more positions of power. You know, it's hard to detach my personal experiences and all the reasons I personally was drawn to this movement from the influences of growing up at the time that I have. But I do think... Yeah, I think that millennials aren't... We understand the world in a very different way than our parents and grandparents' generations did. We don't expect prosperity to just be this sort of inexorable upward ladder. We expect things to not always work and expect to have to find workarounds when they don't, and make do with the world we were handed. And I see that in a lot of people, and I think that that is a very Strong Towns way of looking at things.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious about your insight, Daniel, and your background into the company, was it called Learner, that is actually producing houses that have accessory dwelling units glued onto the side of them. Do I have that name right?
Lenner.
Lenner. I knew I was flipping around some consonants in there. I had never heard of them before I read that article. Could you tell me a little bit about what you know as someone who has a more traditional background in planning and the built environment than I do, about who they are and why their move into the accessory dwelling unit space is particularly significant?
Yeah, I think it's particularly significant because, and it's nothing unique to this specific company, and I don't know anything about this specific company. What I know about Lenner is they are huge. They are the kind of suburban subdivision developer that refers to houses as product. And they, you know, I live in Florida where suburban fringe subdivision development is still very much the name of the game. And they're the kind of developer that will master plan a community of, you know, 5,000 single family homes and get it approved in one fell swoop and build it out over 15 years. And they're operating at that scale, and everything needs to be standardized and everything needs to be a formula. You know, we got these 5 floor plans and you can pick one, but you're not custom building, hiring your own architect if you're working with a company like Lenner to build your house. So what's interesting about seeing them with this next gen model is, in terms of the debate around things like, well, can you have a duplex in a residential neighborhood? Can you have an accessory unit on your property in a residential neighborhood? Or if you try to do it, you know, you try to get the zoning changed so that you can do it, are a bunch of homeowners going to come out fearfully and say, this is going to ruin our property values. It's going to ruin the safety, the tranquil character of our neighborhood. It's going to bring traffic. We can't have it. Those fights are happening in city after city after city when it comes to the effort to simply allow these alternative living arrangements to legally exist. And I think if there is a demand for it that is being acknowledged by a huge corporate home builder, you know, I don't like the huge corporate home builder model. I am a Strong Towns advocate. I don't want to see a developer like Lenner have more clout in the form that our cities take as they grow. But I do think it's interesting in that I think it presages a possible paradigm shift in terms of what the ideal neighborhood supposedly looks like and what is allowed to be built because of the clout that these big players can bring to the table. So I'll be curious to see where that goes. It was the first I'd heard of any developer at anywhere near that kind of scale getting on board with this kind of product.
But you had to ask yourself whether, when push comes to shove, Lenner is really going to say, oh, you can build an like extension onto your McMansion to create a granny flat, or whether they're going to say, cool, you can only do this in the new greenfield development, where we've included one of, as one of five possible layouts, the Granny Flat Deluxe. How adaptable are they really going to be if they're still following this build it all at once to a finished state model, even if that model happens to include a slightly more versatile and durable living arrangement, right?
Well, yeah, the stuff that a developer like Leonard builds is still going to be plagued by all of the problems that we talk about with the suburban experiment. It's done at a huge scale. It's done all to a finished state. It's done in this really fragile way where when the neighborhood starts to go bad, it all goes bad at once really quickly. And it's not adaptable. The idea is that your neighborhood in year 20 is going to look like it looked in year one because nothing is allowed to change. You're not putting an addition on that house. So I have all the criticisms that Strongtown's readers would be familiar with of that model. What I think is interesting is that a lot of the push for incremental infill development in cities that happens at a smaller scale, at a more granular scale, a lot of that push comes up against these deeply culturally embedded notions of what the ideal neighborhood is. And is the ideal neighborhood a row of owner-occupied houses with nuclear families in them and no sort of weird alternative arrangements that might bring renters into the neighborhood, that might bring people from a different socioeconomic strata into the neighborhood? I think that assumption is culturally embedded. I've come up against it when I talk to some of the neighborhood association activists in Sarasota about things like accessory dwelling units and duplexes and triplexes. And so the optimistic side of me says, okay, what this developer decides to do isn't the answer to anything, but are we looking at a near future mainstreaming of things like having a little rental property attached to your single family house and having a tenant live there? And if that becomes part of the vision of what a desirable neighborhood can be for the middle and upper middle class, I think that's great.
It's just this tricky line to walk. I mean, I always, almost always feel comfortable saying, like, Strongtowns is pro-ADU. We are pro-flexible alternative living arrangements. But I almost feel like this Leonard example is one where we wouldn't be pro that, at least insofar as, like, that qua that, you know what I mean? Like that there's this sense of, I can hear in what you're saying, of this might be a good step towards normalizing small apartments attached to a big house, you know, but what we would rather have is the ability for every neighborhood to move to the next increment of intensity over time. We aren't the pro ADU people, we're the pro incremental and iterative development people, right? And that's the thing that's really challenging to explain about Strongtowns to people who want us to say, like, here are the ingredients and the recipe for a strong place. And what we're saying is, here are the cooking methods to, like, bake up a strong place. This whole metaphor is getting a little contrived. But I think I hear what you're saying, but I also am feeling a little bit of a purist Strongtowns pushback impulse to say, like, you can't master plan your way to resiliency. There's no way.
Well, and I don't think we're actually in disagreement about that. I'm not more inclined to support a 5,000 home planned unit development on what used to be farmland because it includes this type of house than I would be otherwise. I still think that that's a terrible model of growth. That is a fragile model of growth that ends badly. I haven't changed my tune about that. I am interested in the cultural shift that it may or may not portend when you see sort of institutional players of this scale get on board with different living arrangements. And that's as far as I really want to go with it.
I think that's a great distinction, and I appreciate you making it. I think one of the things I like most about talking to you, you know, off the record, off the podcast, is you have this sort of pragmatic view of what it might take to actually get strong towns done, that when we step outside of the theoretical pure ideas space, like, you know, what are good signs, even if they aren't the perfect outcome? You know, even if we don't have every city in America today saying like AUs for all, go nuts, everyone, that we do have this one potentially optimistic sign. And you are always, Daniel, I think, super good about pointing out how it could be better, but also praising what's good about it. I just wanted to say I appreciate you. I think that's really great. So let's go to the down zone here. I always like to end each podcast with a couple of recommendations for people of things we've been reading, watching, listening to, podcasts, music, whatever you want, that may or may not have anything to do with the Strong Towns conversation. I'll kick us off this week, since you are new to the podcast, and talk about the very silly movie I just saw. I went to see the documentary Pick of the Litter, which is a documentary about how guide dogs are trained. And I was very lucky that me and my fiance went on a night that no one else is in the theater, because we just squealed at cute puppies for 2 hours. It was incredible. But I think Strong Towns advocates might actually really love it, because the training that these dogs have to go through in order to navigate our built environment is fascinating, and points to exactly how many problems there are with our world. Like, the major test that's hardest for the dogs, it seems like, is they have to train them to walk in sidewalkless roads. Like, if the sidewalk suddenly ends and you need to step into the street and navigate around a car, what do you do? And how do you, like, I had never thought about that, but that's actually a huge component of what, you know, a visually impaired person needs in order to navigate the world confidently and safely. It's not just navigating, you know, here's a curb, here's the staircase, here's a car coming. And, you know, that is a huge part of their training too, but also here is a surface that is probably going to trip you up, and you're going to have to be in a very unpredictable environment. And it was just an incredible occasion to reflect on how our world is built, and also how darn cute like golden and black labs are. They're adorable and I love them. So that's my recommendation for the day, is Pick of the Litter. What about you? What have you been enjoying lately?
That's great. I've been trying to do more reading of actual books. I like holding something paper in my hands. And lately I've been working my way through Salt, A World History by Mark Kurlansky. And it is exactly what it's billed as. It is a history of human civilization through the lens of salt, which is a biological necessity. We will die if we don't have it in our diet. And it has shaped geopolitics. It has shaped migration patterns, all sorts of things that you wouldn't think about in really fascinating ways. So it's been a fun read. And I find that, I don't know, I've got state of the world fatigue. I've certainly got midterm election fatigue at this point.
Who doesn't? You know,
the permanent kind of nervous breakdown that is the Google News headline feed. So I find that reading history is kind of, you know, it keeps me sane. It's almost more real than the present sometimes. And being able to look at human events in that longer term perspective is calming in a weird way.
Food writing is so good for that. I mean, you know that I used to work at a bookstore, and we had this whole display once of books that were just about like one food or one spice. So the salt book was up there. There's extra virgin, which is about olive oil. There's butter, which is about butter. There's lesser beast, which is about the pig. I've read about half of them, and I think they're all so great, because it's just it really controls everything about food. Is just the symptomatic of everything about land use and trade and economics, and it just hits all the right buttons, and also makes you kind of hungry when you read it. So good stuff. Well, that's our show. So thank you so much for tuning in to Upzoned, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, leave us a review, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And if you're looking for another way to support the Strong Towns movement, you can do that at strongtowns.org/membership. You can join the movement and help us bring more podcasts like this and quality content that shines a spotlight on a better way to build the world every day, and we know for a fact inspires a lot of people. Thanks so much, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Thank you.